Welcome to another episode of Tools, Talents, and Techniques. And today I have a very special guest, Mr. Craig Robinson. And his career is it's varied. It's very interesting, but it's very impressive, like every step of the way. So I'm not going to put a label on what he is. I'll let his story do all the telling. So, Mr. Robinson, welcome to the show.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So before we jump into the origin story of your career and your journey, could you just briefly introduce yourself and a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, again, it's great to be here. And whenever someone says your story is interesting, I'll interpret that as it's better to be interesting than uninteresting. And it just continues to be a journey and an exciting adventure. But the quick highlights are, I'm almost a 25-year kind of real estate person, been in this industry for quite a while now. And like anyone who's been in this industry that long, you've kind of moved around to navigate the cycles. But I've also just had some really cool seats that I've sat at around the table. Spent most of my career on the services side with the companies like Trammell Crow, which became CBRE, and companies like that. A few years on the investor side with AIG. And now in this latter, you know, kind of quarter, I'm mostly on the advisory board side. But the more specific steps were, I started with Trammell Crow and in the corporate services and advisory space. I spent a few years doing that. Really loved it. And then I spent a few years with AIG in real estate investment development and came back over to advisory services, running Cassidy Turley's corporate services division, which became Cushman Wakefield years later, but that was my first division CEO gig. And then I spent a few years after that running the U.S. region for Colliers International. So was then responsible for about $1 billion of revenue across capital markets, property management, you know, all of the services that they offered in the U.S. and had an opportunity to help take the company public. And then I had one more run with the brokerage shops. I ran corporate services for Newmark globally. And was also there for the IPO of that company as well. It was a lot of fun. And then I got this idea that I wanted to be, you know, kind of in the tech progressive leading, you know, kind of where's the hockey puck going in our industry? And I went to work for WeWork. And we could talk more about that, but ran a global division for WeWork and later Industrious. And now I'm serving on boards and an advisor to CEOs and giving back in a different way. So anyway, that's the quick story, and it certainly is interesting.
Okay, well, I'm going to dive into a lot of the specifics. So there's a lot of posts or pins that you laid out there. But before we do that, I want to know about like where you grew up. Like, what did you want to be when you grew up? Was commercial real estate or finance or anything in your front view mirror?
Yeah, great question. I didn't even know this was an industry. I didn't know it was a thing you could do. I never even thought about it. I didn't grow up in a family or a neighborhood where, you know, people, at least that I recognize and acknowledge, were in the real estate profession. And so it wasn't something that I thought about until much later. Grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, in Southwest Atlanta, for those who know the area. And my family's been in Georgia for generations, many generations. And I think as a Gen Xer, we kind of grew up doing mostly what we saw the baby boomers do, you know, and what we were nudged and encouraged to do, which is to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, something respectable, something safe, something for where there were groove lines kind of well-defined. And largely what you did was not in service of your happiness, your joy, your purpose. It was in service of safety. What is a safe, good, reasonable job that will pay you well and that you'll be able to have a reasonable existence in society? And oh, by the way, what are you good at? Are you good at math and you're good in science? Are you good at? So with that kind of rubric, okay, a guy like me from Southwest Atlanta, I went to MIT. I studied information technology thinking I'd be an engineer. Quickly realized that I wasn't passionate about that. I wasn't excited about it. I'm excited about people.
But were you good at those things? Because you said like, you know, math and, you know, what things
were
you good
at? Yeah, no, I, you know, in high school, I was good at those things. You know, and I think a lot of happiness for my generation has been defined by, you know, success. Like, what are the things you're good at? What are the things you're acknowledged? Where did you get trophies? Where did you get seen? Where were you acknowledged? Where did you get love? And that's when I felt, you know, seen and loved is when I, you know, I did well in class. I did well in certain subjects. And so the happiness largely came from, you know, excelling. And it wasn't until later that I started to have an interest in other things for where there was not a blueprint. You know, at some point I graduated from college and I did IT consulting. I was with Arthur Andersen. It was a great experience, but primarily the experience taught me that I didn't want to do that. Oh. And I love any job that you can have right out of school, which helps you to test the hypothesis. And I always tell people any place where you can start to get a lot of exposure to a lot of things to kind of quickly want to be exposed to things, but also just test the hypothesis is good. But I realized I was really interested in urban renewal. I didn't use those words. I would have said I'm interested in economic development. I'm interested in like my city, Atlanta. And if you'd asked me then, I thought I'd eventually get into politics. And my thought was like, wow, I grew up in the city. I love the city. I'd love to come back to this city and be a part of transforming it, developing it. Because it turns out that I grew up in a not so great part of Atlanta. And although the city was amazing, there were parts of it that weren't. And I wanted to be a part of like transforming that. And so as I had coffees and talked to people about my interests, you can imagine how people eventually said, you might want to do real estate. Real estate investors and developers and advisors are people who play a big role in that. So I was thinking city, communities, urban renewal, and then back ended into like, oh, real estate is a way to do that. And it was a hard industry to get into. And so I have to say that once I realized that that's what I wanted to do, I didn't know how to get there. I kind of had a sense where the North Star was, but I had no way to get there. And that really is where the story really gets interesting.
Well, before we get to that, and you mentioned you were at MIT, so commercial real estate was nowhere to be seen so far. Like none of your classes, were you doing any type of economic? It was all towards engineering.
I never thought about it, to be honest. I never thought about real estate outside of the home that I lived in. It just never even occurred to me. Like, you know, I mean, and I think in the early days when I imagined that I'd be an engineer, if there was any type of imagination and kind of creative thinking, it was around like, you know, sci-fi. And it was about creating space travel. It was about robots. It was about like, I was kind of a geeky kid, right? Like I grew up reading comic books. I had hundreds of comic books. I mean, I knew any and everything about all of the Marvel, DC, Transformers. Like that's the kid I was, right? Like the idea that I was going to do something in science or STEM or engineering was mostly in service of that. Yeah. But I realized that, you know, while I was a creative type and a dreamer, my passion, like when I really came to life, it was when I was doing things with people. So like, for example, when I was in college, I was class president for 2 years in a row, second Black in the history of MIT. When I was in high school, I was SGA president. When I was my fraternity, I was vice president of my, so like, no matter what I was always kind of on the side doing things with people. And I had to flip that around and realize like, no, actually what you really love is doing stuff with people. You love ideas, you love vision, you love strategy, but I didn't have the vocabulary and I didn't know that those are things you could do vocationally. And so the migration from things that came natural to me, thinking about that being at the forefront of my profession was something that came later. But I'd be lying if I said at the time it was that clear. It's very clear for me to say it today, but it wasn't clear then.
But you mentioned a couple of different things in your leadership from an early age and being in those things. When you look back now, whether it be SGA or, you know, be your fraternity and those things, were there lessons that you learned then that have stuck with you through the rest of your journey? Like, is there anything that stands out now that you like, oh, I remember that happened and that was a tough one to learn, but that really helped me going forward?
You know, the interesting thing is leadership is contextual. Sometimes leaders are reluctant and they're the only one in town that can pull the sword out the stone. And sometimes, you know, leaders emerge and sometimes there's, you know, there are just these moments where you turn around and you look and say, I actually am a leader. Right. I think the types of leaders that we're the most cynical of are the ones who are like, I'm a leader and I'm looking for something to lead. Right. And I don't think I was ever that. At least I'd like to think I was never that. But it was always more so that when I was in environments or organizations where something compelled me, there was a cause, there was an issue, there was a moment where I felt like the right answer is A, and I know everyone else is thinking it should be A, but no one's saying A. I had a certain, you know, confidence, and maybe it was ignorance. You know, maybe sometimes you just don't know what you don't know, but there are just moments where I was saying, like, the answer is A. Guys, it's A. Let's do A, you know.
Let me add something to that, because I think this is important. Sometimes that, like, yes, the answer is A, and how hard can it be to get to A? Right. And a little ignorance of knowing how hard the process is. So I didn't mean to cut you off, but yeah, I think that's,
you're right. I mean, like, you know, you're pump drunk off of, you know, optimism and, you know, and maybe a little bit of confidence, but more so you just really believe in a thing. And I found, like, whenever I felt like I was a zealot for something, I almost kind of had blinders, the way a shark just rips through something and you notice his eyes close and it's just like rip. And I could have one those moments when I felt very passionate about something where I just, like, I'm not even sure how I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it. Like, for example, when I was in college, in, I think it was 1995, it was the call for the Million Man March. And for any African-American male who was in college at that time, in the U.S. at that time, like, you understood that this was something important happening in our community, regardless of the politics and how people view the organizers and the intent and this, that, and the other, because although I was a kid at the time, I understood that people had some positive and negative views of it. But for, by and large, the idea that this was a day of atonement and for men to gather and talk about the agenda in the community was very powerful to me. And I thought it should be powerful to all of the few Black men there were on my campus at MIT. But I went to the institution and I said, hey, I think this is important. And I think we should get buses and vans and take anybody who wants to go down to Washington, D.C., and so I got MIT to fund our trip to go down to the Million Man March. I mean, like, was there any blueprint to say, like, this is something an institution would fund and support? Like, no. I said, but this is an educational, this is a cultural experience. And I went and we sent 7 vans to DC and a few people from Harvard because we had some extra seats. So come on. So we're like, took 7 vans down. And that was just a vision I had. But that's the kind of thing that you know, I found myself doing. And for the rest of my life, it would always be those kind of moments where, even in companies that I worked, where I felt like this is something we should do, this is something we can do, I feel passionate about it and I'm willing to take the chance. And in many times that's worked out for me. Sometimes it doesn't, right? But you learn from those. But by and large, that was always the motivation.
Mm-hmm. I want to jump forward to when you mentioned that you got your, you know, you were doing consulting, you started to get aware of commercial real estate. And then you get into that world. You said it was difficult to get into it, but what were the initial challenges that you faced and how did you overcome them?
The challenge was a fewfold. The first was I didn't know what I didn't know, right? So even the vocabulary to kind of describe what I was interested in, even knowing who to talk to, right? So I started off from a deficit, right? Which is like, where someone who's grown up around this and had people in their lives who did the thing and who coached them or directed them or set them up, I was starting from not even a few steps behind that. I was setting like a few blocks behind that because I didn't even know what to ask for. You know, my entire life up until that point in my 20s was just like, you know, I was almost just on the formula of like, you do this thing, you do this, you do this. And now I'm starting to go off the path. So the first thing that was difficult is like finding vocabulary to describe what I wanted to do in a way that was helpful. Number two, talking to people and figuring out who could help me get there, which requires another thing. Number three, vulnerability. Like, I don't know what I don't know. Can you help me? And that's not something many people feel comfortable doing. And not only is it just like being comfortable is being comfortable with rejection. And so I spent so much time just having coffees with anybody who in the real estate space, I realized this is real estate. So now I'm like having coffees and talking with people. Can you help me? You know, how do I get in this industry? And ultimately I had someone who was he's a great friend now and was then, you know, someone who took an interest in me who helped me get my first internship. And it wasn't a paid internship. I took my vacation time that I had saved up at the firm that I was working for, it was Arthur Anderson, which is now long since gone away. It became, you know, Anderson Consulting and then eventually Accenture. But at the time, it was Arthur Anderson Business Consulting. I'm dating myself. And I saved up my vacation and I went and worked for free, more or less, for Cushman & Wakefield in New York because someone made a call and said, hey, there's this guy, he's really trying to get in the industry. Can you, you know, let him just come up and just shadow some brokers, whatever. And so literally that someone made that call for me that got me that internship. And it wasn't really doing anything highbrow. I mean, I was like helping some brokers, like I was going to write down comps and take pictures of buildings. I mean, it was very, very like not sophisticated. I'd gone to MIT. I was doing tech consulting for Arthur Andersen. And here I am like with a yellow pad, like writing down what I saw at the buildings. But I was like happy to do it and take my vacation. I slept on a buddy's sofa in New York. I've never been to New York in my life at that point.
Were you really happy to do it? I mean, because again, coming from MIT, you were on this path and then now you're, you know, taking notes, getting coffees, taking pictures or whatever else you're doing.
It was humbling, but you know, I didn't think of it that way. I thought of it as like, let me go see if this is something I'd be interested in. But there was also some things that were really exciting. So just, you know, when I graduated from MIT, I worked in consulting, but I worked in consulting in Europe. So I'd had some really cool experiences and I was realizing getting into real estate was going to be hard. And so I decided I was going to go back and get an MBA. So I'd already applied and gotten into Harvard Business School. So in my mind, I'm already moving in that direction. So this was, let me go get some experience. Let me go test the hypothesis. Let me just start the process of getting into this industry. And so it was the summer before my first year of B school, I'm basically like trying it out. And someone gave me an opportunity to try it out. And the work that I did wasn't all that interesting or memorable. And in and of itself, wouldn't have been the type of work would have been like, yes, this is what I wanted to do. But what I was excited about was, it was just my first time. I'm from Atlanta. I'm in this big city, New York, looking at these big buildings. Even if I'm doing something almost administrative alongside these brokers, these are guys with jets. They're obviously wealthy as best I can tell. I'd never known anybody who had the kind of money like the brokers I was meeting at that point in my life. I mean, they literally had jets. And then also too, one of them would always, you know, he took an interest in me and he would always insist that we meet and have lunch at the Harvard Club. I'd never been in spaces like that. Now, obviously it just got into HBS, but I still, this was all still very foreign to me. And you know, just to be in rooms where like the type of caliber of the people in the room was just really interesting to me. So the work was less interesting. The exposure to the space, the ecosystem, the personalities, what they look like, what they dress like, the things they're talking about, that was really more interesting to me. That the size of real estate, the just the sheer magnitude and scale of the buildings, right? Like, so all of that had a huge impression on me. You know, and I think it further cemented that this is something I wanted to do. You know, my first year business school, like everyone's first year in business school, you're really just focused on like the classes and the courses and trying not to like hit the wall, fail out, whatever. You're like super nervous about like, you know, whether or not I belong here or not. But I was clear that I wanted to do real estate. And it was interesting because at the time, dot-coms were like a really big thing and everybody was trying to start a company. This was the, you know, this was 2000, 2001. My first year business school was 2000. And I'm interested in something that's kind of like not super exciting. Everybody wants to go do a startup, dot-com stuff. That was really, really huge then. And if you said, hey, I'm interested in real estate, people thought like, what do you want to be like residential broker or something like that? Like, if people didn't really have an understanding of like all of the different careers and different things you could do. And I didn't either, to be honest with you. I just knew I wanted to do something with space. But I felt like I wanted to be on the investor developer side. And so I thought, I've got to find a way to get to Wall Street. I got to find a way to get to the money side of the coin. And so I spent my first summer working at Goldman Sachs. And Goldman didn't have a way for me to work directly in real estate. But I thought like, if I could just get some of the polish on me, some of that Wall Street polish on me, and let me just be in the room with the money people and be in, you know, kind of the epicenter of like where money changed hands and deals were done. I was moving in the right direction and I worked in their M&A and investment banking group. And it was the first time I'd ever realized that I was one, not good at something, two, I didn't enjoy it. And three, I need to be a little bit more clear about what I want to do. The work of investment banking is super sexy. It was cool to tell all my friends I'm working at Goldman Sachs and I'm doing this really cool stuff. But the reality is I really wasn't good at that work. I wasn't good at, reading financial statements and like working 23 hours a day, like, and with an hour of sleep trying to put together a book for something. It didn't play to any of my strengths. And it was an important summer because, one, I respected those for who it was their strength and they were good at it. And I respected the institution and I had a great experience in terms of exposure. But I realized that I needed to be more focused on going back to what is your passion and what is it specifically you want to do in this space, and really try not to get lost in the woods of things that sound good, things that everyone else was doing. Because ultimately, the work that I've done in real estate has largely been non-traditional. And even to this day, that summer has given me the strength to kind of largely walk a slightly different path in the industry. And we'll talk more about that. But that summer was really pivotal in me seeing that.
Do you feel like, you mentioned a couple of times that you sometimes you don't know what you don't know, right? Right. And so you coming into this industry from a non-traditional path, right? You're coming into this and not only seeing, being exposed to these different spaces and these rooms and these people, and you're like, oh, I didn't know what this was like. I didn't know, you know, how this world works. Do you feel like you had some type of advantage / disadvantage with your engineering background or from that mindset? Do you feel like anything that you brought into that allowed you the opportunity to say, hey, why don't we try this and not that? Or why don't we look at this?
It's a great question. I don't know that there was anything in my formal training besides critical thinking and reasoning and, you know, which those things are, you know, lifelong in service of any and all things you do. But I do think what was important for me was more the EQ than the IQ. The EQ, which was like, I can do this. The EQ was, I felt a certain kind of, you know, calling, like I'm supposed to be here. Statistically speaking, I'm not here. Statistically speaking, there's no reason why I should be here. Statistically speaking, there's no reason why I'm in this room while I'm in this, you know, this office in this building sitting next to these people. I grew up in Southwest Atlanta. Nobody in my family, I can't even describe what I'm doing. Like, they wouldn't even understand what I'm doing. Like, there must be a reason why I'm here. And even in moments where I doubted myself, either my capacity or my capability, I always felt like, but there's still a reason why I'm here. And so that allowed me to be passionate about the quadrant, even when the coordinate was not clear. I know I'm supposed to be here. I don't know where in here I'm supposed to be, but I'm supposed to be in this quadrant, right? And so I wasn't overly disappointed when a coordinate didn't work out. Like, this X and Y, like, that doesn't feel right, or this is not maybe my, but I know I'm in the right space. And that, and so I think what served me well was less so like I've been trained in a certain methodology for solving these problems. Like, no, I think I just had a whole lot of like stamina, endurance, and like sense of purpose, which, by the way, when things were darker, more unclear, or more actually antagonistic, which it certainly became years later in my life, you know, I would say that more than anything. I don't think I've ever been the smartest kid. I don't even think I've ever been the most qualified or capable. I just think, if I'm doing something, I believe in it. And that is a pretty, pretty rich fuel source.
Yeah, that's amazing. That thought process of what you're saying is like, I don't know specifically what this is, but you had a feeling. There's a, you know, to put it in musical terms, you're playing a note. It's like not the right sound, but it's the right chord, right? Like it's not ringing out right, but it's not. Yeah. It right. And so how do you figure that out? And you play by feel for a little bit. That's amazing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Whenever someone says, tell me about your story or tell me about your success, there's a slippery slope, because typically that, you know, we tend to want to go back and tell a very neat linear story. You know, first A, then B, then C, then D. And generally the line kind of goes up like this, right? We do that, one, because that's an easy story for people to understand. People want a formula. Tell me what I do. What do I add water to? How many times do I steer? And will my cake come out the way yours came out? Mm. And so we listen for almost instinctively to the A, then the B, then the C, then the D. And also, we have a way of looking back on our lives where the truth of the matter is it was a lot of noise. It was a scatterplot. A lot of moments, some were random. Maybe they were all random. Some were random, some were intentional, some were, you know, causal, some were correlated, but it's a lot of things that happen. You know, why did I have an interest in a certain thing? Why did I meet someone who was willing to help me get an opportunity over here? You know, my summer in Goldman, it was an interesting one right before 9/11. Why was I there? But anyway, you go back and mathematically you draw a straight line through a scatter plot. It's a lot of dots, but you draw a neat line and then you erase the dots. And people then see like this really clean line. And that's the way they imagine your life. But that's wrong, because then it leads someone else to think that their line is going to be clean and neat. It's not. It's going to be a lot of randomness. And it's up to you almost to like understand the connective tissue, understand the purpose, the what is the thread line, what is the theme. But be okay with the ambiguity. Be okay with the randomness. My life is still random, even to this day, but my biography does not read random. My biography reads very linear. No, it reads exponential. There's the moment where you go into the town square and you pull the sword out the rock, and then like, and now you're the leader. But that's not really the way it works. And so I want to resist the urge to make it that easy and clean. I would just say, you know, the themes have been a sense of purpose, a sense of listening to myself. And then I will say that there's some things that I have found to be helpful in terms of like understanding the relationship between randomness and the line, which is understanding three things. One, figuring out what it is that you're really good at, right? Sooner rather than later, experiment if you have to. And then most of all, being okay and comfortable with the things you're not good at. I had experiences early on in my career and also in school where I'm like, I'm not really good at that. This is sexy. I'd love to be good at that, but I'm not. I'm really good at this. In my case, I was good with people. I was good with sales, marketing, strategy. Those things didn't line up neatly with being a big Wall Street real estate investor. Like, no, I was actually really good with people and strategy and ideas and making complicated things simple. I was good at that. Then the next thing is like figuring out what you're really passionate about, not what someone else is passionate about, not what the crowd is passionate about. You can't crowdsource happiness. You can't crowdsource your passion. Your passion has to come from within. And so whenever someone, and this is really common in B school, but it's also very common in industries like ours, where you kind of look to the right and left and you're like, well, what is everyone else doing? What is the cool thing? What is it that we all want? Like the truth of the matter is you may not want that. You may not be passionate about that, but you feel like you should be passionate about it. I very early on found myself passionate about things that were not mainstream. I was drawn to challenger brands. I was drawn to innovation. I was drawn to like novelty, which led me to work for companies that were kind of upstarts and doing weird things. And I took roles in those companies that played to my strengths. And then the other thing too, is just figuring out the lifestyle you want, right? You know, like work-life balance, that's one aspect of it, but risk reward, the how do you want to spend your time? And I have found that if you could just keep what you're good at, what it is that you're excited about and passionate about, and the lifestyle you want, if you can keep those three things in balance, you generally will, you know, by and large, find yourself on the right path.
Yeah, and that's amazing, that balance. And I think those are three key things that I don't think I quite put it in that framework, but that's the key. I mean, that is everything, actually, when you think about it.
It's a framework I came up with a few years ago. It's called JAIL. What are you good at? G. What is it that you're excited about? E. And then what is the lifestyle you want? L. And the key is to keep that a perfect equilateral triangle. If you ever find yourself doing something that you're good at, you're excited about, but it doesn't play to the lifestyle you want, you're going to be disgruntled. You know, I'm not seeing my kids. I'm stressed. I'm taking too much risk. So if it skews. If I do something that gives me the lifestyle, the money I want, I'm passionate about it, but I'm not good at it, you're not going to be a top performer and you're going to get weeded out. If you do something you're good at, gives you the lifestyle you want, but you're not passionate about it, you're doing it for the wrong reasons, you're going to burn out.
And I would say this, because a lot of these times and these, all right, let's step back for a second. Because what you said about seeing that linear line and like, oh, this is what it is. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of the things that I love about having the show is that we can really dissect some of these areas where people are like, oh, then I did this and then I moved to New York. It's like, well, wait a minute. Why did you do that? Like, because in our minds, we start to skip over some really important things when that is where the lessons are. That's what people want to know. Like, what was that thing that you said, you know what, maybe I want to do this? Or like, what were you doing when you had that idea, when you talked to that person that prompted you to go there? And so that's like pulling those things, the different tools, talents, and techniques from people's experience is one thing that I really love about the show. And so one of the things that I would ask of you to be to dive into a little deeper, when you have a decision to make, when you're saying this, you know, this gel, this GEL, right? And you're at this point, and maybe it's a feeling that you say something's off, you know, I'm not spending time with my kids, I'm not really good at this, I need some help. Like, is there a process that you have to dissect the feeling? Like, when you have the feeling, do you meditate? Do you walk? Do you write it down? Like, what are things that you do when you have that feeling?
That's a great question. It's an excellent question, because the signs and the signals and the information, everything that you need to know may be there, but you may not want to hear it. You may not want to acknowledge it. You may be in denial, right? If you go back to each one of those things, because I have done all the things that I'm going to tell you not to do. I've done them. That's why I know it's so easy to do it. It's so easy to stick with something you're not really good at, because we live in a society that tells you to keep trying, work harder, you know, get an extra tutorial, double down, get a mentor to help you get better at this thing, versus saying, quiet, let me think about what it is that I'm really good at. What is the thing that I can do easily that no one else? And even if it's not sexy, but that requires courage and self-awareness. And so a lot of it has, at least in that situation, required me to kind of be okay pulling back from the crowd, and okay just saying, you know what, this may not look like the way everyone else's vision board looks, but I've got to have some level of confidence that it's the right thing for me. So that's number one. And that may be, to your point, you need to pull away from, you need to remove yourself from a certain space, because we're social animals, and social animals want to belong. We want to belong. We want to be accepted. But maybe you're right around the wrong animals. maybe you need to have fewer, right? So, you know, for me, it was important when I graduated from school, and even in my second year, I stopped hanging around all the cool kids, right? Like, everybody's like, I'm going to do private equity. I'm doing venture capital. I'm doing this. And it was really hard to hear what I wanted to do, because I'm so in tune to listening to what everyone else is doing. So that's number one. Like, you've got to find a way to turn down the volume on the crowds, because otherwise you're going to crowdsource your own passion and your stuff. And you don't want to do that. And also to get really comfortable with and pay attention to what you're good at. And if you don't know, then you need to create experiences to test it out. So that was one of the things that's really important for me. The other thing too was I had to get comfortable with failing, because the only way you're going to realize, I thought I liked this thing, but I don't like it. Or I thought I was good at this thing, but, and that requires you to take some chances. And we also, particularly people in our community, my generation, Gen Xers, we are hardwired to do things that are less risky, more certain, more predictable. There's past data that suggests that this is a good thing. You know, we grew up like talking to our mentors, what should I do? Blah, 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 blah. I remember when I was young, I used to always read Black Enterprise. I just always wanted to read. And I just read their biographies. Like, all I would do is just read, like, whoever they're talking about and read their biographies. Like, and for me, I was always looking for the A, then they did B, then they did C, then they did D. And you almost like, that's, and if somebody throws like a Q or R, it's like, it throws you out of whack, right? So like, part of it is like, you know, getting to the point where you're willing to take risk, even if you haven't seen it before, but you got to take some risk. So that's the other thing, is being comfortable and taking some bets on yourself, being comfortable leaning into your strengths, even if they're not, you know, clear how you're going to make money or do something with it. And also just being really focused on the things that you really are passionate about. And that means turning down the volume.
When you talk about being willing to take those risks when you see them, because you're passionate about them, whatever, is there, because you are an analytical person. Like, yes, you have high EQ and all those things, but you're obviously a very intelligent person, and you make these, is there anything like, do you write things down? Do you have a process by which you make decisions? You know, a simple as a pro con list? Is there anything like that?
Yeah. You know, so I have a few frameworks, but the frameworks have come later in life because I think in hindsight, I realized, you know, for example, when I realized I wasn't in my jail and in my jail, I need to be over here, I realized that there's a way to pivot. There's a way to pivot. And I would think about there are three P's that define how best to pivot. The first P is our people. In the marketplace, you'll be defined and valued for who you know. P will be process. What inside the organization is the function or the thing that you know how to do? Sales, marketing, investment, whatever. The next P is like the product or the industry or the sector. And you've got to realize that at any point in time, those are the three P's that define you. But if you want to get from here to over there, you've got to figure out how to pivot one of those at a time. I'm going to keep my network, but I'm going to change my function. I'm going to stay in the same industry. But ultimately, maybe I want to change my function and my industry. So I've got to change these out one at a time. So I've used like frameworks like that to help me think about pivoting. I've also, you know, I've also had a board of advisors, people who knew me well. I've also, who would give me the hard answers and be like, Craig, why are you doing this? Why is that interesting to you? You know, on my hubris or push back on my excitement, I can get excited about things. And like, I'm a Sagittarius. I could just, if I'm excited about something, it's powerful. Like the juggernaut. Once I start running, you can't stop me kind of thing. But I have some people who could stop me and be like, Craig, just relax, sleep on it. See if you still feel that way. So board advisors have been really helpful to me. Number two, everyone talks about sponsors or mentors, but let me just say what those two personas did for me. I had mentors who I was comfortable being safe with. I was comfortable being vulnerable with. So people who I could go and say, I have no idea how to handle the situation. I'm running into this issue. I feel safe telling you that. There were times where I knew in roles, even when I had very senior roles, that I felt I was probably failing, or if not failing, I was heading in the wrong direction and I didn't know how to turn it around. And generally speaking, it was because of like my inability to manage certain politics or certain types of conflict in the work environment. And I needed help. No one that I grew up knew, you know, had experience dealing with some of these types of things. But it required me to be vulnerable with certain people and say, I need help. And that wasn't something I grew up really knowing how to express, because you're so comfortable to like showing up, you know, like I've got it figured out. And, you know, because you've been projecting all your life, you've always been over your skis. So if anything, what you're trying to do is just like prove to yourself you can do it and prove to everyone else. But there's sometimes it's okay to be like, I'm not sure I can. I need help. So that was number two. So board advisors, you know, right kind of mentors, but being coachable, being vulnerable, made mentors more useful to me. And then sponsors, many of the opportunities I had that were meaningful and step functions, like, so going back to that scatter plot, like all of a sudden, like there's one dot that just jumps up like an outlier. Like, okay, what could happen between this cluster of dots and then all of a sudden this one in your life where you just stepped up? For me, I went from being an individual producer contributor to being a division president. There was no logical reason why I should go from being an individual producer contributor to running a P&L, a national P&L in a company, which was then Cassidy Turley. But I had a sponsor. I had someone who said, Craig, I think you could do this. Based on what I know of you, I think you could close the gap. I didn't even know if I could do it, but I had a sponsor who thought I could. And that sponsor's in a room you're not in. And that sponsor's advocating for you, like, give this person a chance. If I told you a story of my career without talking about the role of the sponsors who were ahead of me in a room I wasn't in, who saw something in me that I didn't even see, who pushed me and pushed the organization to like give it a try, I'd be lying to you and certainly myself. And if I told you that even once I got in that room, there weren't times where I felt I was failing or underperforming and I needed mentors to be like, okay, if you're going to stay in this room, here's what you got to do. Thank you. Like, and if I told you that I didn't have a board of advisors when I felt low and I felt dark and I felt alone, just like, you got this, man. You look, you came from Southwest Atlanta. You're here. Like, you're supposed to be here. Like, I don't have room in my biography for that, because that really is my biography. That really is a story of who I am. But you ask, like, what are the things I do? I'm just very sensitive of the role of those people in my life.
That is unbelievable. That's fantastic. And I think that is the thing that of that scatter plot and that thing, if you were to, turn that on its axis and see what the common theme is, all that, it goes back to what you originally said.
Yeah.
And that's people. And that's being with people and creating those relationships and that connection and all the other stuff you can do, like, spreadsheets, somebody else that loves doing that can do those things as long as you can understand at some level. But really, when you have those people that you can generate those relationships with, that's been the key, So I'm glad to hear you say that. That's deep.
It's an interesting thing because, in some communities, at least the ones that I come from and maybe you come from, we spend a lot of time focusing on our technical skills. In some way, in some part, because we've grown up in a society that has told us that we weren't smart enough, we weren't talented enough, we weren't capable enough. And so the inclination is to want to over-index on qualifications, like get more degrees, more certifications, more classes. I remember, right out of B school, I was so concerned with my technical proficiency. I've got my crib sheets, I've got my little things, I've got my models, I've got my whatever. In B school, I'm highlighting all of the cases because I need to know every little thing. And the assumption we make wrongly is that it's our technical expertise that's going to get us to where we want to be. The technical expertise is almost expected. And if you don't have it, you can't get in the room and you certainly won't stay in the room. But it has been least important of all the things that I've learned about not only my success to what degree you would call it success, but even as I think about those who I feel like you've had an amazing run, it's mostly your ability to build relationships, to build trust, to build followership. And it's the EQ side of things that keeps people from being technically proficient to being a leader, whether it's a formal leadership or an informal leadership, having a voice, to having influence, to being meaningful in whatever organization you're in. And when I oftentimes talk to people who are stalling in their careers or they're not having the success that they envisioned that they would, it's oftentimes not because they don't know how to do the thing, right? You can run the model. You can put together the pitch deck. You know as much about the thing as anyone else. It's how do you communicate? How do you disagree? How do you build trust? How do you work through conflict? How do you manage up, down, laterally? And those are the classes, if you even have a class that speaks to those six things, we generally, that's soft. That's like the fluffy class, or that's the thing like, no, show me how to like solve the equation. Okay, great. But unfortunately, if that's where your learning stops, you probably are not destined to a lot of success, regardless of what you aspire to be. And so I would, to your point, just nudge anybody who's thinking about where they are in their career, where they want to go, think about the EQ, think about what it means to be human and to interact and to inspire and to induce things from other humans.
And both you highlighting that both those things are important, but that, we're all social creatures. We're all humans, that we all have like needs and wants and desires. And one thing that you just said that jumps out to me, how to disagree.
Yeah.
How do you disagree and know and be in a room with somebody who, you take into account their feelings, their, how do you listen to somebody? How do you say, okay, this, but maybe this too, and because they have, their ego involved and they have their career goals and their fears and their anxieties. And I feel like navigating that space is so important because most things that you do are going to involve other people.
Yep. We're living today. We're recording this in 2024 at a point in time in our nation, but really globally, but we are experiencing mostly in our nation. A level of polarization that we haven't seen in recent history, and maybe ever, but certainly in recent history, that we're showing up with more conviction than curiosity. We're showing up in every conversation, almost without fail, with conviction. And we're confusing conviction, which there can be a very, very powerful and important role for that. And it's necessary with moments where we need to be curious, Why do you feel the way you feel? What is it that led you to believe that? What experiences have you had? I may still disagree, but if I at least start from a place of curiosity, it opens up the door for us to find where we have common ground. It also opens up the door for us to have empathy and to maybe get to a place that we can agree to. But I am finding this in work. I'm finding it in our politics. I'm finding it in popular culture that I may not be able to induce curiosity in you, but I can have it in myself, showing up with a little bit more humility. And I would just say in our own lives, one of the ways in which I think we can disagree without being disagreeable, or just in general, like remove some of the friction that we experience moving through life, is to introduce a lot more curiosity. And I'm working on a book right now where I'm spending a lot of time thinking about this topic, which is like, what are all the areas of my life, whether it's faith, whether it's relationship, whether it's career, the right way to have a career that's predicated on conviction, for which if I double clicked on that folder, conviction, what's in it? Is there data? Is there science? Is there anything that would substantiate me having conviction? And for so many of my folders, I've had conviction for things that I don't know why. And why I should, and why am I willing to be a martyr for something that actually I should just be a student, not a martyr?
First of all, congrats on writing the book and good luck. I mean, everybody I know has written a book. They said it's an ordeal. So good luck with that. But you know what? It's funny to hear you say that, or I shouldn't say it's funny, but it's interesting to hear you say that you're really formulating that now, and that's gelling. No pun intended, because that's your work. But like, that seems to be the theme throughout your life. If that curiosity, of following that curiosity, or joy, or things that you like, the things that you want to explore. So to hear you in real time, really putting that together and standing on that, it's something special, man.
Yeah. It is. Thank you for teasing that out, because just as you said that, I realized it has been a consistent theme. And there was another word you used, which I think is perhaps one of the most powerful ones right now. It's particularly in this season. And I wish I had it be more front and center in my life sooner, which was joy. We have largely viewed happiness as a byproduct of life, not the purpose of life. In fact, one of the themes that I write about in my book is the IRR of happiness. Anyone who's an investment professional knows that you can make any investment make sense if there's a big enough residual pop at the end, your exit multiple, your exit cap rate. And even you could have negative cash flows for a long time, as long as you imagine there's this big IPO, there's this big thing that's going to happen. And if you can believe this big thing in the end, then you will endure a lot of really unhappy things in the meantime. And we do this in our happiness, in our joy, and our careers are examples of that, where it's like, if I can just like make it to the point where I'm vested, or I make it to partner, or the fun, you know, we're in our carry or whatever it is, but I'm not really enjoying what I'm doing. I'm not in my jail. I'm not passionate about it. I'm not playing in my strengths, whatever. Because I'm assuming in the future, I'll get to be happy. I'll get to retire. I'll get to do the things I want to do. But let me just slave my way through the next few years. I think that's horribly flawed. And the fact that we move through life and so many assumptions about like the relationships we stay in, because it'll be better if I exit it later. The jobs we stay in, it'll be better if I exit it later. You know, the things, I'm going to stay in this city, I'm going to stay in this home. There's just so many things, which I think the calculus is always, let's defer happiness when it's not binary, and looking for ways to bring your joy forward and put everything else in service of your joy. The job, the work, your career should be in service of your joy, not the other way around. And it sounds obvious and intuitive, but we oftentimes are not willing to do the hard work to make that relationship true, which is like, you know, that doesn't bring you joy. It may make you a buck, but you're not going to be joyful. Bring that joy forward. And so anyway, that's also something you said, and I agree wholeheartedly with. It's like, we've got to make joy the center of a lot of things we're doing.
I love it. Well, you know, we're coming up on an hour now, and I want to be mindful of your time. But also, I think there's a lot we still have to cover. Would you be open to having a part two of this conversation?
Absolutely. Especially when my book is done, I'm going to come back and talk about the book.
Well, because we did, because there's so many different things of all the different boards that you're on, and you know the WeWork, and yeah, there's so much I still want to go through. But I'm so impressed with everything that you've done so far. I'm excited to see what happens next, and this book, but everything. But more importantly, thank you for everything that you're doing, and your leadership, and your vulnerability, and your being willing to be open and share your journey. It's impressive.
Well, thanks for this platform and thanks for giving me the opportunity. And I look forward to joining you again. It'd be great.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Mr. Craig Robinson, everyone.
Thanks, Justin. Take care.
All right.